Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an historical perspective on race riots in America, going back to the 1960s, where invariably the spark that ignites the protests was the killing of a black man by a white policeman. James Myerson, who served as an assistant general counsel of the NAACP and who now maintains a civil rights trial and appellate practice with a long-standing focus on law enforcement misconduct, joins us. We'll discuss his article in the Huffington Post, What is the Koerner Commission and Why It Should Be Revisited in Light of Ferguson, and the need for a similar high-level inquiry like the 1968 Koerner Commission today to curtail the life and death power of local police and hold them accountable for the abuse of the unique power they have with a license to kill. Then we will look into the changing demographics in St. Louis with Colin Gordon, a professor and director of undergraduate studies at the University of Iowa and author of Mapping Decline, St. Louis and the Fate of an American City, which is also an interactive digital mapping project on the web at Mapping Decline. He joins us to discuss his research that shows racial and economic stress building for years is the tinder fueling the anger and frustration that has exploded in Ferguson. Then finally, we will speak with Garrett Duncan, a professor of African American Studies at the University of Washington in St. Louis, about the extent to which outside troublemakers from as far as New York and California are fanning the flames in Ferguson, and the turf battles amongst the various federal, state, and local police who have been unable to quell 10 days of protests and looting, as well as the need for adult supervision to take charge of the situation and conduct a swift and credible inquiry that results in accountability and justice. And joining us now is James Myerson, who served as an assistant general counsel in the office of the NAACP general counsel from 1970 to 1981. He currently maintains a civil rights trial and appellate practice with a long-standing focus on law enforcement misconduct. He has an article at the Huffington Post, What is the Koerner Commission and Why It Should Be Revisited in Light of Ferguson? Welcome to Background Briefing, James Myerson.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So let's start with that question. What is the Koerner Commission? It started out, of course, after the race riots of the 1960s. President Lyndon Johnson appointed the Illinois Governor Otto Koerner to head up the commission, and it issued a report. And I take it that the main point that you're making here in terms of what happened then and what's happening now is that what the report made clear and what history has since made clear is that the trigger for most of these race riots that have happened in this country invariably come from a confrontation between a local white policeman and a member of the African-American community.
That's correct. And they also concluded that what existed then exists now, which is that the local minority communities across the country where these riots were taking place, triggered by these law enforcement confrontations, that the communities thought of the police as an occupying force. Police or military force that was there not to serve their communities, but rather to protect and secure the interest of what was perceived to be the privileged white communities, and that these police officers that comprised the occupying force, so to speak, harbored racist attitudes toward the residents of the minority communities that they were charged to serve. And the Koerner Commission then said, and the context for those triggering events was all important. That is, racially segregated communities, inferior schools, extraordinarily high degrees of unemployment, and insufficient and inadequate government response and attention to the community needs, which sort of created, and I'm using the author Chimamanda Adichie's phrase, creating an oppressive lethargy of choicelessness that grew out of what I would describe as the government-sanctioned inequality and second-class citizens of the minority citizens, which was waiting in the context of these trigger incidents to explode. And so I pose in my article, does that sound familiar today in 2014? And the answer is self-evident. Of course it does, because we have racially segregated communities, inferior schools, high degrees, extraordinarily high degrees of unemployment, lack of services and attention to the needs of those communities, all waiting to explode. And when we have the trigger incident, and it explodes. And so my thought is, and I urge the president has very little power to do anything concrete. He can speak to matters. He can send the attorney general to look into the matter and perhaps prosecute on a federal level. What he can do is engage us in not a superficial, fleckless dialogue, but a serious look at where we are 50 years after the Kerner Commission. And I would suggest he would, rather than having Otto Kerner or the equivalent of a governor, he have Jimmy Carter and George Bush chair it and put some prominent black and brown and white individuals on that commission with a staff of renowned people throughout the country and in different fields to look at it honestly and courageously. That is, look at our past and look at the legacy today and then plot a course that does something concrete about it rather than have us talk about it in the abstract. Teddy Roosevelt once said long ago that those who fight the system in the abstract achieve mighty little good.
Again, I'm speaking with James Myerson, who served as Assistant General Counsel in the office of the NAACP General Counsel from 1970 to 1981. He currently maintains a civil rights trial and appellate practice with a longstanding focus on law enforcement misconduct. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, What is the Kerner Commission and Why It Should Be Revisited in Light of Ferguson? Now, you mentioned the President of the United States, who has spoken out, and he's sending the Attorney General on Wednesday to Ferguson, Missouri. But in your Huffington Post article, you start out by saying, the most powerful person in the world on a day-to-day basis is not the President of the United States. No, it's a police officer. Your local police officer has the authority and power to take your life and more often than not get away with it, particularly if you happen to be a black or brown male in our society. So here you are. Here we are in 2014, and the Kerner Commission report came out in 1968, and it's deja vu all over again.
That's correct. We always say, how can this happen? And it happens, like I said before, because the conditions that existed 50 years ago today that led to explosions exist perhaps even at greater levels than they did then 50 years ago. You know, Frederick Douglass, in a famous speech that he gave at a Quaker meeting house, Friends Meeting House in Rochester, New York in 1852, was entitled What to the Slave is the Fourth of July, said, we must do with the past only as we make it useful to the present and the future. So I say to the president, who has far less power than that everyday police officer on a daily reality basis, convene a new commission. Say courageously that we are far from a post-racial society and that it's time to reconfront what we knew existed in the past and make it real in the present and do something about it for the future. Otherwise, it'll be the same constant refrain that I always make when addressing the civil rights issues of today in the context of the struggles of yesterday, everything changes and nothing changes.
Well, indeed, James Myerson, a new poll by the Pew Research Center finds that the U.S. is responding to these police killings of Michael Brown pretty much along racial lines.
Well, that's right. And that's because we are constantly saying we need to have this candid discussion. And we might have a kind of less than candid discussion for a brief period surrounding a particular incident, and then we move on, and we then kind of applaud ourselves when, for example, in 2008, we elect as President Obama, and we sort of begin to rationalize. To me, rationalization is the means by which we justify lying to ourselves and then lying to each other about whatever we're speaking to. And so we rationalize that we have moved forward because we do something or we have a discussion, and yet the conditions remain the same, waiting to explode.
So, James Myerson, what, though, can be done specifically in terms of the police themselves? Because all police officers are not trigger-happy and are not racist. And there is a thing called police professionalism.
Correct.
Ray Kelly, the former commissioner of the New York Police Department, has come out today saying that the police force in Ferguson is just simply not up to scratch. I mean, it's just not professional.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's a police force that doesn't reflect one in any degree the community that it's serving, and it's a police force that is clearly overwhelmed in the context of the policing function required to be taken in the circumstances at hand. I mean, it's not probably overwhelmed in stopping and issuing a summons for a traffic violation, but in today's contemporary world, police forces need to have much more sophisticated policing policies and practices, including community relations. And by the way, back in the 70s, when I was on the staff at the NAACP, we were talking about the same issue with respect to, if you will, affirmatively integrating those police forces. And in major cities, we have successfully undertaken that effort. But in communities throughout the country, we still are failing. And so, to me, that's what this commission can hopefully focus us on, to say how we have not succeeded on so many levels, but where we have, as a nation and as a community of people and common citizens in this country, where we've failed. The solutions to the problems are not easy, but that doesn't mean that we can't and shouldn't be doing things now. And the professionals, Ray Kelly, various people in different walks of life, can plot the course of what needs to be done in the next 10 years. Look, at when Kennedy said in 1960, I want to put a person on the moon in the next 10 years, the country committed itself concretely, including economically and in every manner and fashion required, to achieve what everybody saw was that's an impossible goal, and they achieved that goal. If, in fact, there's a commitment to making this that more perfect union, now 250 years or whatever the number of years is since our birth as a nation, it's time in the next 10 years to commit to making us this more perfect union, and there's a lot of things that can be done. I don't pretend to know because I don't have the expertise, and what you need to do to make those inferior schools better, what you need to do to desegregate communities, what you need to do to provide adequate services, what you need in law enforcement to serve all people. But there are those pros out there in all of these fields that can do it. All you need is the commitment.
Well, it seems to me, though, James Myerson, since 1968, things have not improved in terms of the underlying economics and racial disparities. The one thing that can be achieved, I would think, at least it could be mandated, and that is greater professionalism amongst the police. Because if you say, and I think your point is well taken, that on a daily basis your average cop on the beat has more power than the president of the United States, because the local police officer has the authority and power to take your life, and more often than not get away with it. So there's two obvious things that come to mind. One is that if you are going to give that power to individuals, then they have to meet incredibly high standards of psychological testing and rigorous training under conditions. It seems like in this case, the policeman who shot this young African-American, Michael Brown, just lost it. I mean, and just...
Well, that's correct. And there, I've worked with, for example, a gentleman who's got a PhD. His name is Guy Seymour. And Guy was a former deputy chief in Atlanta and a PhD in psychology. And his specialty was risk containment and stress management in the context of law enforcement. There are people out there, and what they do is put into place systems and standards and processes by which you select those who are going to perform the duty, by which you train them, and by which you oversight them. And big-time cities such as New York and L.A., and I've used Dr. Seymour as an expert in some cases I've done in the past, but big city police forces have those psych services and selection processes and procedures. That needs to be mandated everywhere, no matter how big or how little the force, and you can figure out how to weed out those who have pre-inclinations, however they're masked, to not to be able to perform the law enforcement duty, which is, as I've said, and as you've repeated a couple of times as I said it, which is necessary given the power that a police officer has on an everyday basis to everyday citizens wherever they be.
Well, in the second part of what you say, though, is that the policeman has the power to take your life, but more often than not get away with it, particularly if you happen to be black or brown, a black or brown male in our society. Now, that's another that is obviously an area where something can be done. Now, right. My understanding is that actually a father, there's an article in Politico about this today, from the father of a young African-American boy who was shot to death in Wisconsin. Again, a relatively progressive state. Yet this white policeman shot this young man in cold blood and got away with it. And the father, who's an Air Force veteran, got a settlement and spent the settlement on putting up billboards and educating the public and taking out full-page ads. And eventually he got the law changed in Wisconsin, which means now if there's a police shooting in Wisconsin, the police department cannot investigate itself. And we've seen what's happened in Ferguson, where the police department, rather than investigate itself, is trying to exonerate this officer by basically slandering and maligning this young man who is the victim.
I spoke about that earlier today on another program, which is there needs to be a movement afoot in each of the 50 states where it doesn't now exist to take the investigation and prosecution of law enforcement agents out of the hands of local prosecutors and put it in an office of a state prosecutor for law enforcement personnel when these events occur. I say in that regard, Ian, that prosecutors and police officers, they're all common to the term law enforcement personnel. They're part of the same family. And just as a prosecutor could not prosecute, investigate and prosecute a case of a homicide of his own, of a member of his own actual family, because it would be a conflict, and if not a conflict in actuality, which I think it would be, at least an appearance of conflict, just as the prosecutor could not do that and would have to have another prosecutor step in and do the investigation and prosecution, so too, because of the family law enforcement relationship between local police officers and local prosecutors, states need to create statutorily the requirement that when there are situations of police shootings or other brutality of significant consequence, the special prosecutor's office for that state, wherever within that state, will undertake the investigation and prosecution. You're absolutely correct on that. That is something we discussed in the 70s. It keeps being spoken of periodically when these things arise, and it's time for that to happen, because when the feds come in, and it's useful that the feds come in, and I was involved in some litigation which gave the federal government the policy to allow the dual kind of investigation and prosecution. The problem is that the feds have to have as a predicate for their prosecution the requirement that the officer specifically intended to assault and or kill someone to violate that individual's civil rights, which is quite a different element than simply that the officer intended to insult somebody or to shoot and kill. And the standards are much higher on the federal level, making it more difficult for the federal prosecutor to bring that kind of case, even though they have dual jurisdiction to investigate. Now, of course, that can be changed too statutorily in Congress. Ha-ha, Congress does nothing. But in theory could be changed to lessen the standard for the federal prosecutor in that context. But I think, practically speaking, Ian, the best approach is to start getting through the political process and however it's done, the state jurisdictions to enact special prosecutor statutes that mandate automatic special prosecutors in these kinds of circumstances.
Well, just in closing, James Myerson, what do you expect to happen in this case in Ferguson, which, of course, is hardly resolved? This is in the 10th day of rioting. And if there is not a credible investigation soon with unassailably accurate results, this thing could go on forever. I mean,
well, what I think is going to happen is clearly I think the federal investigation will be a credible investigation with the force of the FBI, the number in that force out there looking at it, and the independent autopsy. And I'm not pessimistic that there might even be a federal indictment, but there'll be a credible federal investigation. I think what the governor needed to do and what the governor should have done, given the familial relationship between the local prosecutor and the local cops and this sort of this the protective cocoon in which they exist, I think the governor should have had a special prosecutor appointed, and maybe that yet will occur, because I don't think that they can proceed on a local level with any degree of credibility. So I guess we're going to wait and see. I mean, I think that the federal investigation is going forward timely, the optimistic part of my personality propels me to believe that there will be a federal, potentially a federal prosecution, but if not that, some special independent state investigation and prosecution.
Well, James Myerson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with James Myerson, who served as an assistant general counsel in the office of the NAACP general counsel from 1970 to 1981, and he currently maintains a civil rights trial and appellate practice with a long-standing focus on law enforcement misconduct. And he also has an article at the Huffington Post, What is the Koerner Commission and Why It Should Be Revisited in Light of Ferguson? We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the author of Mapping Decline, St. Louis and the Fate of an American City.
There's a woman on my block. She just sit there facing the hill. She say, who gonna take away his license to kill? Now he's helping for destruction. He's a fading confusion.
Students all confused and party, weeping through each other's arms. It's murder. No absence in the mother's arms. Even the warmth of a mother's arms could not keep a son from harm. I'm standing where the gun was drawn. Overcome, done and done, he gone.
Murder.
She'll shell like a bell and run. The blood burst, body temperature fell and plunged. And in the time it took the medics to come, the breath eased out of his lungs.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Colin Gordon, who's a professor and director of undergraduate studies at the University of Iowa. He writes on the history of American public policy and political economy and is the author of Growing Apart, A Political History of American Inequality and Mapping Decline, St. Louis and the Fate of the American City. And his digital projects include Mapping Decline, an interactive mapping project based on his St. Louis research. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colin Gordon.
Delighted to be here.
And clearly there's a history going back to the 1960s of race riots being sparked by either a white police shooting or beating of an African-American, and Michael Brown is the latest spark. But the tinder that fuels the anger and frustration and resentments in these communities that have exploded, as they have in Ferguson, clearly have been building for years.
Yeah, I think that's entirely accurate. These are communities that are ripe for these sorts of confrontation, precisely because a long history of background discrimination and segregation in both housing and employment is so potent.
And in terms of employment or unemployment, I guess, my understanding is that the part of Ferguson where Michael Brown lives, 50% of the men are out of work?
Yeah, and that's, I mean, pretty close to the national average for young African-American men living in these sorts of settings. I mean, as a general rule, the African-American unemployment rate is about double the white, and the rate for young African-American men is almost double that again. So I think in Ferguson proper, across the entire town, the unemployment rate is close to 20%. This in a city that, you know, recovering a little from the recession is at 6 or 7%.
So tell us about your book, Mapping Decline, St. Louis and the Fate of the American City, and the digital project that you've done, a companion, which includes Mapping Decline as an interactive mapping project, which is based on your research. So clearly, you have sort of visualized, I guess, this extraordinary demographic change that's taken place in a matter of two decades, where the entire nature of the city, particularly of this part of northern St. Louis, has changed from three-fourths white to two-thirds black in a matter of two decades.
Yeah, and I think, it goes back even further than that. What I try and show in my book is that St. Louis was a systematically segregated setting in which occupancy of white and black was separated by a variety of public and private policies enforced by the real estate industry and by the courts, and then perpetuated by forms of exclusive zoning in the suburbs that grew up west of St. Louis. And what this abetted was a generation starting in the 1940s of white flight from the city into these new bedroom communities, heavily subsidized by federal money. And in the wake of that, the city, in many respects, began to collapse. It lost its fiscal capacity, its ability to pay for schools and safe streets. White families could leave because they didn't face discrimination in housing. But African-American families were, in a sense, locked in the city because the suburbs were restricted either by a formal rule or by practice, the way in which real estate industry operated locally. The African-American families then do escape the city in the 1970s and 80s, a process that continues today, and filter into the housing stock left behind by whites moving west, initially in the central city and then in inner suburbs like Ferguson.
So the whites deserted the city for the suburbs, and then a couple of decades later, the African-Americans locked in the inner city then, in a sense, inherited these vacated homes of the whites who've then moved further out into more affluent or more rural areas. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is you have an African-American population which is generally poor, and they're filtering in to the older stock housing. But also, I think the more fundamental issue is, I mean, one way to think about it is that African-American families and white families in the region want the same thing. They want public safety, they want good schools for their kids, and the like. White families had the opportunity to leave the central city a generation earlier. It was not until the 1980s and 1990s that the formal and informal restrictions against African-American occupancy in St. Louis County began to crumble, that African-American families had the same opportunity. So in these waves of migration west of the city, leaving vacant neighborhoods and vacant properties behind, it's first a wave of white flight and then a wave of black flight following a generation behind.
Again, I'm speaking with Colin Gordon, who's a professor and director of undergraduate studies at the University of Iowa. He writes on the history of American public policy and political economy and is the author of Growing Apart, A Political History of American Inequality and Mapping Decline, St. Louis and the Fate of the American City. And his digital projects include Mapping Decline, an interactive mapping project based on his St. Louis research. And where can people look at and study your interactive website, Mapping Decline?
Well, there are two sites, actually, and if you just Google Mapping Decline, they'll both crop up. One is hosted by the University of Iowa Library, and it picks up the main narrative themes of the book. The other, more complicated and interactive site, which contains virtually all of the data I use in the book, is hosted by the Harvard World Map Project, and it allows you to play with the layers, to turn them on and off, to fade them in and out, and see the relationship between things like zoning and African-American occupancy and patterns of development.
So what explains, though, the political disconnect here, where you have, in this suburb of Ferguson, you have two-thirds African-American, but of the 53 police officers, only three are African-American, and six of the seven city council members are white. So are six of the seven school board members that run this school district, whose student body is 78% black. And my understanding from talking to people in the neighborhood and professors at the university there, that, you know, these whites who are sort of hanging on in this atavistic way, and, you know, leads you to wonder, are the African Americans not voting? And how do they allow these little fiefdoms to continue?
Well, I mean, I think you put your finger on two questions. One is the persistence of these little fiefdoms. I mean, St. Louis is an exceptionally fragmented metropolitan area, over 100 municipalities in St. Louis County alone. And in the little crescent between the city and its airport, 20 or 30 postage stamp municipalities, of which Ferguson is one. It's much easier for a displaced now minority like the whites of Ferguson to cling to political power when it's fragmented in that way. Certainly African Americans, in part because it was a sort of large multi-class African American community in the city, did assume some of the levers of political power. There are strong African-American wards. St. Louis has had a string of African-American mayors in the past. So partly it's the fragmentation of the metro area. Partly it's the fact that the population is very transitional, and so the demographic change is running ahead of the political change. But then the final point, which I really think you put your finger on, is it's just a question of political capacity and the willingness and ability of people to become politically active. And we do know from a wide array of sociological research that when people are strapped economically, when their personal and financial and family circumstances are difficult, their political participation collapses. And when you have an African-American community that is not firmly rooted, that is transitional, it is missing a lot of those sort of secondary associations like churches and trade unions and community groups, parent-teacher organizations, that often are the sort of font of local political activity. And all of that, I think, is missing in a community like Ferguson. So, you know, it's both, as you characterize it, the sort of atavistic hanging on of the former white majority, but it's also the sort of political incapacity of this sort of transitional African-American community.
And I take it that kind of tragedy of democracy, if you will, it's prevalent across the United States in a sense, isn't it? The people who would most benefit from political participation and who are most punished by lack of political participation are the ones that don't participate simply because their lives are overwhelmed by simple survival.
Yeah, and I think it's a combination of the sorts of obstacles that face people of very ordinary means who might not have the luxury to go to to a city council meeting, let alone run for city council. But it's also most Western industrial democracies have poor people, and they have much higher rates of voter participation than the United States. There are obstacles to political participation in the U.S. that start with our two-party system and include, many of the sorts of constraints on the franchise that have been introduced in recent years.
Well, also the safety net in this country is so, it's not only is it frayed and under assault, it's totally inadequate compared to other social democracies. And that in many ways relates to how the wealthy in this country control our politics, because we were a social democracy, I think arguably from 1947 to 1977, and at the height of the American dream in the 1950s under President Dwight D. Eisenhower, the richest Americans paid 92% income tax. Now, the Mitt Romneys of this world pay about 15%.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is you're exactly right. Is the growing inequality gap on wages, incomes, and particularly on wealth. And part of it is again, as you suggested, that being poor in the United States is substantially different than being poor in other countries because. The floor underneath incomes is really much lower. Imagine, for example, a setting like everywhere but the United States that has universal health coverage. That establishes a sort of substantial floor of security, higher minimum wage, and the like. So, I think you're exactly right. This growing gap, which is driven both by the collapse of constraints at the top and by the shredding of the safety net at the bottom, really contributes to the sort of anger that we're seeing in Ferguson today.
Well, Colin Gordon, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Colin Gordon, who's a professor and director of undergraduate studies at the University of Iowa. He writes on the history of American public policy and political economy and is the author of Growing Apart, A Political History of American Inequality and Mapping Decline, St. Louis and the Fate of an American City. And his digital projects include Mapping Decline, an interactive mapping project based on his St. Louis research. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the various federal, state, and local police have been unable to quell 10 days of protests and looting in Ferguson. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Garrett Duncan, who's a professor of education and of African American studies in arts and sciences at the University of Washington in St. Louis. He has an article at The Takeaway, In St. Louis, A Long and Troubled Past with Race. Welcome to Background Briefing, Garrett Duncan.
Thank you.
And the Pew Research Center just came out with a poll, which unfortunately and sadly shows in pretty stark contrast to the different opinions of white Americans and African Americans about what is happening in Ferguson. For example, a question by the Pew Research Center, do you have or have not much confidence in the investigation into the shooting? 76% of black respondents say they have no confidence, and only 33% of whites say that. So that's just an example of the disparity. One of the paradoxes, I think, here is that we think of some of these northern states, like St. Louis, being relatively progressive. You've got, I think, a pretty progressive senator and governor, yet you've got these clearly reactionary police. So how do you explain that disconnect?
Well, I'll explain it in a couple of ways. First, progressive is relative. For example, I will tell you our senator, if you're referring to Claire McCaskill, and our governor, for the most part, during their campaigns to be reelected, they actually distanced themselves from Barack Obama. In fact, they're somewhat short of Jan Brewer in Arizona, but they make it clear that they are going to Washington not to co-sign him, but to fight him everywhere, and that's part of the local politics. And then but things have changed a little bit with Eric Holder's intervention, which actually I believe what Jay Nixon, the governor, is doing these days is actually in good faith. Now, but on the other end, the divide has to do with electoral politics. When we talk about Ferguson, Ferguson is a suburb in what is called North County, and we have three major counties. We have South County and West County. South County is incredibly affluent and predominantly white, and West County is predominantly white. And North County, where Ferguson is predominantly black and far less affluent. The poverty rates are astronomical. And so when you have officials elected at the county level, such as the sheriff or the county prosecutor, they are largely elected by the largely white residents of the county. And so you have the West and South County actually making decisions for the North County. So the county executive and the county prosecutor, as well as the people they appoint all the way through the police force, are not responsive to nor representative of the North County. So that's part of the divide.
So just to touch on the politics of Senator McCaskill and Governor Nixon, do they distance themselves from Obama because the majority of the electorate in Missouri is conservative? In other words, do they have to come across neo-Republicans, if you will?
That's exactly it. And, you know, and this is the irony. Missouri is considered a Democratic state. You know, we are, I don't know if we're blue or purple, but almost all of the elective officials are from the Democratic Party, and that runs the state pretty much. But at the same time, there is this deep conservative strain throughout, and many Missourians, and we have to understand another thing. When we think about Missouri, St. Louis and Kansas City are urban areas that are predominantly black, people of color. They're the immigrant hub. So that's where you have the most diversity. But Missouri in and of itself is about 80% white, and it's mostly rural, and it's mostly conservative. And I mean conservative in every sense of the word, whether it's marriage equality, immigration, reproduction rights, is very conservative. And our elected officials tend to appeal to those sentiments.
So let's talk a little bit then, Garrett Duncan, since you're in St. Louis, about what's happening at the moment. And this is, of course, the 10th day of unrest in this suburb of your city, St. Louis. Garrett Duncan, again, a professor of education and of African and African-American studies in arts and sciences at the University of Washington in St. Louis. He also has an article at The Takeaway, In St. Louis, A Long and Troubled Past with Race. The latest reports indicate that the new sort of, it's difficult to know actually from this end, and you can fill us in on this, Garrett. Mm-hmm. Who's in charge in terms of law enforcement? You've got layers of them. You've got the National Guard. You've got the State Highway Patrol, led by Captain Johnson, who seems to be trying to sort of single-handedly keep a lid on things. And then you still got the county and local police as well on the scene, do you not?
Right. You could not have asked a better question, because most of the people outside of St. Louis must look at us and the Ferguson situation, and they must be shaking their collective heads. What you have, you have it correct, but then there are these internal politics. In fact, there's infighting. When Jay Nixon finally stepped to the plate last Friday, after hearing, getting an earful from Eric Holder, who had both the stick and the carrot, either we will withdraw resources from you, or we will provide you with resources to do what you need to do. So you do the right thing. This is when Jay Nixon actually called on the highway patrol to replace the county or the local level law enforcement agency, which just bumbled and stumbled. And in fact, most of us believe they are the main reason for inciting a lot of what we call the violence going on. But now, this is the irony. The highway patrol is responsible for protecting the protesters. They have no arrest or detaining power. They cannot arrest anyone nor detain. They can only protect. Now, the protecting and serving powers are for the local county officials. Now, because of what Jay Nixon has done, the local people, including the county prosecutor, I mean, it's like they're having a collective temper tantrum, and they're sitting on their hands because their authority has been usurped. It's that chronic local state or federal, argument that goes on. So what you had happen on Saturday was, after the state patrol left, they had no power to arrest or detain. After they left, after doing their job, the county, who is responsible for protecting and serving, actually sat on their hands as people from far away from California and New York have come in, as well as the outlying counties and even the city of St. Louis, who are not part of Ferguson, would come in and do their misdeeds. And so this is why I believe now Jay Nixon, or excuse me, Eric Holder, called on the National Guard, because the National Guard actually has the power to arrest and detain. And I think, and I'm hoping, that things will go for the better.
So, Garrett Duncan, tell us about these people that have come in from New York and California to stir up trouble. Who are they?
Well, these are folks who are just taking advantage of a vulnerable situation, and this happens all the time. And the reason I was asked before, how do I know these are outsiders? What do I mean? Well, when these people are detained, their IDs are taken, and that's how it's ascertained that you're not from Ferguson, you're from these other people. So you always have these fringe elements, and these are not folks seeking social justice. And for the most part, there are a lot of black folks involved in this. They're not in love with creating the ideal impossibility of creating justice for black people. They have no knowledge of Michael Brown or even of the circumstances. They just know that this is an exploitable situation, and they've taken full advantage of it.
So in terms of this inquiry, though, Garrett Duncan, it would seem that it needs to be swift and accurate and credible and unassailable. And I don't understand why
the feds are limited in what they can do.
Right.
You can only refer to the civil rights statutes of denying somebody their civil rights, as opposed to charging people with the murder. Only the local authorities can do that. And I don't understand why a special prosecutor hasn't been appointed, because frankly, as you just pointed out, the parochial interest of these police, they feel like they're on trial. They've got all of that turf and territorial stuff. They're in a snit. They're the last people you want investigating this.
Absolutely. You have a situation here where we're in Dred Scott County. You know, this is a Dred Scott country. And as you recall, the Supreme Court decision said that there were no rights that a black man had that white men were bound to respect. And we saw that it came out in bold relief with the case of Michael Brown, where he had the right to live, but that right was not honored. You have Captain Johnson, who was supposed to lead. He was supposed to be in charge, but at every turn, you had people on a local level undermining him. So there's this issue of race and history going on, and I've never seen such unprofessionalism on the part of a public agency than I have over the past few days from the very get-go with the county police agency. And it's inexplicable. It's very difficult to explain, but it plays out on television every day.
Well, Garrett Duncan, I mean, nothing is more graphically illustrates your point than the fact that the police shot at the press and arrested a bunch of journalists. In fact, they arrested another photographer today. I mean, you know, you got to be pretty brain dead not to recognize that if you start beating up on the press and beating up on the messenger, you're not going to look good. And so do they care, these people in the local police and county police, do they really care about what the rest of the country thinks? Or are they aware of the fact that the spotlight of the country is on them, if not the spotlight of the world?
You know what? Their attitude is, and you got it right. You got it right. You know, I can almost understand if these things were occurring under the cover of darkness, under the cover of night, but they've been very brazen in their public misconduct. The attitude that I sense from them, as I have from other people, is, you know, first of all, you have people who call Missouri, Missouri, and you have other folks who call it Missouri. You know, these are folks who call it Missouri. I don't understand that pronunciation. And their attitude is, we're only accountable to our people here. And they have a groundswell of support. And I'm talking about the officers. You know, you even have the KKK coming in, raising money for Darren Wilson on his behalf, and they see him as a victim and that he was doing their job. So their attitude is, as long as our people are behind us, you know, everyone else be damned. That's basically their sentiment. So, yeah, they're fully aware, and it's almost as though they're glowing in that kind of publicity. It gives them street cred, to use a term.
So what's your sense then of who can sort of break through this? And you know, this needs adult supervision, doesn't it? And
right, you know, I never used that term, and I'm gonna quote you on that, and I'll give you credit. That's exactly what's going on. In my view, the only thing, you know, there's certain steps, and you know, there's different takes on this, but one thing, the county, the local authorities, they need to be relieved of their duties. They need to be, before Darren Wilson is arrested and, you know, brought up on charges, the local authority have been brazenly insubordinate and unprofessional, and placed residents, the public, in harm's way with either their actions, whether the military actions or their inaction, allowing people to come in. So they need to be completely stripped of, I mean, they need to turn in their badges and their guns, and we need to have both the statewide troopers and even with the backup of the National Guard, because Captain Johnson is the real deal. I have not met him. I know a lot of people who know him and have met him or just recently, and he has the confidence of people. he needs to be put in charge without the possibility of being undermined. And he is the adult supervision. He is the adult supervision. But first and foremost, these local folks, they really need to be, you know, stripped of their duties and their responsibilities.
But aren't there some structural problems in the sense that, you know, apart from the demographic problems, that in two decades, Ferguson has gone from 25% African-American to about 65 or 70% African-American just in two decades. And apparently this is a cash-strapped city. And of course, we know that there's, what, 53 white police and about three African-American police on the police force. And one of the ways that the police force maintains itself is through harassing motorists by giving unnecessary tickets in order to
right.
get revenues. And that surely doesn't endear them to anybody, white or African-American.
Right. Well, you know, we have 90 municipalities around here, and it's very much different from many places where I lived or traveled, where if you cross a street, you're in Ferguson, you cross another street, you're in Riverview Gardens, and you cross yet another street, you're in St. Louis City. So you have all these different police forces, and in fact, what you've seen over the past several days was a coordination among different police agencies in the St. Louis metropolitan area. Now, but they, for the most part, were under command of the local Ferguson or North County police agency. And so I'm saying that 53 in the law force is relatively small, and that could be more than compensated. And I think that's part of what we are seeing in terms of the additional resources being brought in by the federal government, you know, paying for overtime. You know, I've actually heard that being put around by Captain Johnson. You know, let's pay for overtime. And we get folks from some of these other jurisdictions. And I'm not saying that's going to be a solution because we don't know how they will respond. You know, as far as I'm concerned, there's a brotherhood, a fraternity of police officers, and they might take exception to any negative action taken toward their brothers in Ferguson. But I think, you know, if we're creative and we're really serious about it, I think we could come up with at least some short-term solutions.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Garrett Duncan.
It's been my complete pleasure.
And likewise, I appreciate it, Garrett. Again, I've been speaking with Garrett Duncan, who's a professor of education and of African and African-American studies in arts and sciences at the University of Washington in St. Louis. He has an article at The Takeaway, In St. Louis, A Long and Troubled Past with Race. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.